A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Two men collide, rival nations. It's a primitive clash, venting years of frustration. I guess what I'm trying to say is that if they can change and you can change, we can all change. It's time for Flats and Shanks.
Okay, ladies and gents. We're going to make a start very shortly. If you can start to grab a seat, I see a few of you have been up for seconds already. Please bear in mind, Jason and Flats haven't eaten yet. Where's that Nick? I just saw Nick take about four burgers at the back there. That's pretty selfish. Well done, Nick. I'm Matt Powell. I'm just going to be here, just keep things going along tonight. I played with Flats and Shanks at Saracens. I was pretty shit, so I didn't play much rugby. And then I had the pleasure of playing with Jace for 3 years at Quinns as well. So, again, didn't play much rugby there. So, a bit of admin. There's a fire escape there, but just look after yourself. Run. There will be a break. So, if you can just sit still for the first half. We'll go for about 35 minutes, and then we'll have a 10-minute break. Recharge your drinks. And then there will be an opportunity for questions as well. The last live podcast we did in Bath, people were pretty shy about asking questions, but just go for it. There will be some editing, so if it is really, really shit, we'll just cut it out. So don't worry about that. And if you cannot take any videos, that'll be great, because there's a lot of content that gets cut. Shanks doesn't really like questions or stories about his mum. So they all have to be cut out. So please don't record anything. Jace is an absolute legend. He'll have a million stories. He probably could keep going for a few hours. I don't remember too much about my time with Jace in terms of stories. I just remember he's got a massive set of nuts. And the whole teabag initiation is still a bit of a nightmare for me. So Jace will be on top form, I'm sure. We've got the Welsh albino, and we've got Big Fat Dave as well. So it's going to be a great evening. Hope you enjoy it. And I want to thank Darren from Fuller's, Harriet from the Townhouse, and Luke from Guinness, who've put on all the food, looking after us with the beers. So thanks very much to all you guys for all your support. Flats and Shanks want to do their own introduction, so they're going to introduce themselves in a few moments. So enjoy the pod, and I'll be back later on. I'll go around with a microphone for the questions later on. Enjoy.
Mate, we're ready now.
Parley, we're ready now. Can you tell them we're ready?
Yeah, they're ready, boys. They're ready, and girls.
Okay. Right, go, Shanks, go.
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for two of the leanest, greenest charity workers this side of Calais. Flats and Shanks.
Got my suitcase. I'm staying the night.
Thank you.
Jokes aside, has anyone got anywhere I can stay tonight? I'm actually in London without a room.
Listen, please give your MC, Matt Powell, a round of applause for entertaining you there for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
If you do want to see a little bit more of him, tune in to Channel 4 on Thursday nights, Embarrassing Bodies. He's on there. And last time I saw Paul, he was looking for a left-handed snooker cue. Did you find it, mate?
Hey, I tell you what. Hello, everyone. Firstly, hello. Thanks for coming. I remember I've known Paulie a long time, since we were kids, really, young in the game. And there's been on loads of stag do's and all the stuff that everyone else has been on and all that kind of stuff. And there's just one, whenever I see Paulie about 2 or 3 days a week, every week of my life for the last 20 years. And who remembers Chris Forty, who played for Gloucester at Hooker and played for Worcester? Everyone remember Chris Forty? 4-0. Just want to, if you're ever going on tour, lads, and you're, or ladies, and you want to put a few quid together, start chipping in early, get a fee together and take 4-0 with you, no matter where you're going, because he's the best bloke in English rugby. And whenever Paulie walks into a room, and they played together at Worcester for years, whenever Paulie walks into a room, he just says, "Paulie, take your face for a shit." That's it. And then he just says, whenever Paulie, like, it'd be 20 times a day, "Paulie, face, shit." That's it. It just used to break me.
It's good advice, actually,
yeah,
isn't it?
Good advice, yeah.
Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the Flats and Shanks podcast, sponsored by Guinness and Fuller's. Just a bit of a cheer, come on, just for the...
Hey. Hey.
This always sounds better on the podcast. Welcome. We do have a special guest. I bet you're all dying to guess who it is.
Yeah, you know who it is. It's an absolute... The word legend gets thrown around way too liberally these days. And... especially when you're talking about people who've accumulated a lot of caps for minor nations like Wales and Scotland. But what we got is a bona fide rugby icon. You might know him as the Fumbus. You might not. You might know him as the Leopard. He's got 114 England caps. He's the most capped English international ever by 25 caps. So it's not just about, he's not just hanging on. It's a record that may well and probably will never go. He's been on 3 Lions tours. He's won Grand Slams, 5 Nations, 6 Nations. He's won the World Cup. He's won everything. He's done it all. He was at Sarries for a season or two. Then he was at 14 years a Harlequin. So he's just probably the biggest legend in English rugby. Ladies and gents, Jason Leonard. Up there, Jace. These seats, they all say reserved at the front. Who are they reserved for? Shanks' mates. Anyone can have them now. If you're at the back and you're all standing up, there are 7 seats here you can sit in.
Only if you're short.
Can we get some beers in Powley? It's the end of Jan. We can pretend not to be alcoholics
Jace
anymore.
Jace is still on dry Jan, but Shanks and I will have. By the way, those of you that, well, actually, you all listen to the pod, of course you do, or most of you do. You all have heard of our Michelle, right? And our Michelle, who organised loads of this stuff, didn't bother coming to the last pod. And she made sure I didn't introduce her tonight because she's not used to being in the public eye and she gets embarrassed. So she's sitting just here at the front. Thanks, Chinface. So, Michelle, stand up and give everyone a wave. For those of you listening to this at home, on your. There you go, Jess.
She's recently had twins as well, so.
So no, take it easy ideas on her. She had a glass of wine about 3 hours ago and she's smashed.
Especially this one here.
Anyway.
That's how they start.
Jason.
Common animals. Anyway,
Shanks, can we get on with it, yes, and be professional, ready, please, for Christ's sake? Jason, wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for coming down. I gather you've come from just around the corner, so it's not a long trip for you.
Yeah, no, it works just around the corner. So I think everyone who's in the area... The problem with this area, you've got all these great pubs and you walk past all these pubs, everyone wants to stop you and have a quick beer. And I had a couple of smart asses sort of say, "Come on, Jase, join us for a beer. Monday's the new Friday." You're like, fuck off.
It's like when Rocky Balboa goes for a jog through Philly. It's like you walk through the boozing districts and you're knackered. You've got to basically have a disguise, but then your body shape when you walk means that whatever you wear, they know it's you, right?
It's a dead giveaway. Yeah. It's a dead giveaway.
So what are you doing these days? And when you say work's just around the corner, what is that? What are you up to now?
So I work around the corner for an insurance brokerage. And it's one of these ones, I think it's hard for a lot of rugby players to find that transition. We, and you know this as well, as being an amateur player as well, we found it.
He didn't mean in standard.
That wasn't taken.
Didn't mean in standard.
No, I mean, because we actually worked before. If you talk about these like someone like Johnny Wilkinson has never known anything except professional rugby. So we used to work and rugby was our hobby. It became our job, which was the best job in the world. So a lot of these younger players find it very hard, the transition from playing and the adulation of the game and everything like that to then going into mainstream work. So,
did you not find that difficult? Was it kind of natural for you because you'd sort of done it before?
I think I most probably carried on very amateur-like in the professional environment, really. I'd carried on working while I was still even in the professional game. And then, as luck would have it, then you fall into a load of roles with the RFU. I come and sat in the RFU as a RFU council member. Sort of brought the average age down by about 30, 40 years in that aspect. And then I was quite lucky that I managed to get on a presidential rollout, if you like, because it's like a four-year piece of work.
Yeah.
You don't just do it for 1 year, it's 4 years.
Okay.
So you're a junior vice president, you're a senior vice president, you're president in the third year, and then your last year you're immediate past president. And then you drop off, literally, you drop off everything then, really, after that.
So that role, I mean, I saw you a bit during that, sort of before, during and after, but it always interests me because as president of the RFU, it's a massive role, and I don't know what it entails, but what I can imagine is you putting suits on every day and going to this lunch, this dinner, this lunch, this dinner. So do you finish the year about 8 stone heavier than you start it? Or is it not just dinners and lunches?
I think there was a book running on me about how much weight I would actually put on by all the older players. And I think the highest was I'd get up to over sort of 22 stone.
Yeah, that's the danger zone.
I think I got...
I know about that.
I think I most probably was just underneath it by a pound or two or something like that. I think I just shaved it.
It's come off now though, Jace.
No, I've got rid of it now, but it has taken a couple of years to do it.
What are you doing? Just eating well? Cycling?
Trying not to eat. When you're doing this, it's great because it's a true, how can you say, ambassador for the game. So everyone wants to take you, come to our rugby club, come and have a few drinks, come to this lunch, come to this dinner.
Yeah,
it's brilliant the reception you get from the game. But at the end of it, literally, you're avoiding anything that's sharp just in case you pop. Sort of thing like that. It's And I mean, it is one of those ones because the role itself, you are wheeled out at every single opportunity and you feel a little bit like, I was going to say, well, a little bit like an American president kissing babies and shaking hands.
Less of a bell end, the American.
Yeah. But one without his thumb over the button, sort of thing like that.
Visually you can see you've lost weight. I mean, that's the best thing I like about you, Flats, is that, you know, you let yourself go and you just don't give a fuck.
You know what? Upstairs, you'd expect us to be talking about, like, you know, lad stories and all that. We've been upstairs for about an hour. And we were, but immediately before we came down, when sort of Michelle came up and said, right, come on down, I was talking, Shanks wasn't really part of it because he's naturally, I was talking to Jace about, have you got the weight off, Jace? You know, I started, you know, and you do honestly get to a point, I've never been present at RFU, but I go to a lot of events, and you do get to a point, mine was 2 weeks ago last Monday, where we had this day out with Lawrence arranged this day out, and I told you, I've talked about it in the pod before, but we just had this massive day of booze, basically. So we had a load of wine, a load of pints, and more Chateaubriand than 12 large men could manage. And by the end, I mean, there would have been, it's incredibly wasteful when you put it like this, and you probably hate me for it. There's probably, you know, 5 kilos of meat or 3 kilos of meat left on the table. We couldn't eat any more. And I got onto my bed in my hotel at about 5:30, and I was drunk. And I'd overeaten, had an amazing day with everyone. And I thought, this is... And I didn't eat a... I wasn't ill. I didn't eat a large meal for 5 days after that day. I shit you not. And still now, I'm not eating... excuse me. So still now, I can't eat. I'm not eating... I mean, large meals, larger than all of you lot eat, but not as large as I normally eat. And there does come a point where you think it's actually toxic now. It's toxic. And my wife weighs me in every morning now. She weighs me in, and I'm away from home. And she's last week, and I'm staying at this hotel. And she's like, "Have you weighed in?" I was like, "I'm in a hotel. Go to the gym. They've got scales. I've checked." Yeah.
So you left the RFU presidency, but you were saying upstairs on the way out though, you've been offered another role, with
almost out the door.
It reminds you very much of the Godfather, Al Pacino in the Godfather. Like the family keep on dragging you back in, sort of thing like that. So as I was about to leave. So at the end of the season, the RFU has a committee meeting, then an AGM, so the Games AGM, so annual general meeting. And after that, I should have literally just dropped off the perch. That was it, I was done, sort of thing like that. And before I've even left that meeting, the new chairman, Andy Cosnett of the RFU, said, I'll tell you what, Jase, we've got the British and Irish Lions role coming up pretty soon. I think you'd be really good at that. And I sort of went, Jesus, Andy, I've not even left the building yet. Can you not wait until, give me a bit of time, sort of thing like that. He said, just have a little think about it and stuff like that. And it is, it's something that I have said, I'll go on the board for the British and Irish Lions. The Lions is in a period now where it's got to look at itself. I mean, a fantastic result down in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I mean, considering what the Lions is and how they come together and its short preparation and all this. And again, the players involved and the clubs and the great work that they do. So we've got to make sure that we give every single person that goes on a Lions tour a real opportunity of winning it, not just going down there and gamely getting beaten 3-0, which is what everyone thought was going to happen in New Zealand, which I did read. I really did enjoy the post-match in New Zealand when they sort of asked Steve Hansen, what was that like? And he said it was a little bit like kissing your sister. And you're there thinking, New Zealand's a small place.
Yeah, you'd know, mate.
You might know that. So then like that, you're thinking, that's not really what you should be coming out with. But I think everyone most probably at that time was a little bit down about the result because obviously it was a drawn series. But I think afterwards, especially from a Lions point of view, our guys should be very, very proud of what they achieved because only one other team's gone down there and bettered that in 71.
So you went in 91, didn't you, to New Zealand?
93 to New Zealand.
93, sorry. How did you find out? Because a lot of the guys now, they find out literally on Sky Sports News. How was it? How did you find out you were selected?
I told this at a dinner a little while ago, and one of the players here did ask. I said, I found out someone was watching CFAX.
Yeah.
So it came up on CFAX, and then someone rung me up or rung someone to get me, and they told me I was selected. It was on CFAX. And I was talking to one of the young players, and I can't remember who it was. Literally went, what's CFAX?
Yeah, exactly.
That makes you feel very, very old.
So Bamboozle's on there, isn't there? It used to be. Some of you will know.
So, Jase, you're part of this. Yeah, some of you will know. You know. And if you know, you know, you know that you know. We'll wind it back in a minute and talk about, sort of start the old days a little bit. But in this new Lions role you've got, it's kind of, I'm sure you love it, and you've got obviously got a great passion for the game and all that. But do you feel like there's almost a bit of responsibility for you? Because, you know, you're like all three of us, too old to play elite rugby now, but in rugby committee terms, still in your 40s, you're a young member of these committees. So do you feel like as someone who gets the modern pro game, you've got kind of a bit of responsibility to shake up the Lions a little bit, shake the tree a bit and sort of alter how perhaps it's arranged or selected or scheduled or something when you're in there?
Yeah, I suppose I think that's part of the reason why I was asked to go on the board for the Lions. The Lions have done so well, and it's still very similar to what it was back in the day. And it's making sure that we bring them up to the modern day. And again, giving them those opportunities, as we said, whether it be time or whether it's time together, practice games. I mean, you've got to look at all three tours. They're all slightly different in different ways. But you can still look at Australia and South Africa. New Zealand's one of a kind. I mean, it is a different league. They're rugby mad down there. You could fill out any stadium playing the Lions. You don't have that same madness when you go to Australia because rugby union is, God, I mean, after Aussie football rules, rugby league, soccer, cricket. Mm. I mean, soccer is most probably a bigger participation sport than rugby union there in Australia. Right. So Australia's come right down. So again, the matches you're going to play are not going to be of the same sort of standard that you would find in New Zealand. And slightly the same with South Africa being on the Dan side at this moment in time. Their club rugby's not great or their provincial rugby's not great. And their international team's not great as well. So they're not exactly the same threat as what they was in other years. But you go to New Zealand, any side you play, it's going to be a tough game. So we've got to look at these tours differently and prepare for them differently to give our players the best chance and the coaches as well. Because, I mean, if it becomes increasingly harder to win a test series in any one of those three countries, who's going to take it on?
Yeah.
Because it obviously will be a sort of black mark on the book as such, on the coaching book, for a coach or a manager.
It's so
or
high profile,
it
will always be associated with their name, won't it?
Yeah. So we've got to make sure that opportunity, we create those opportunities for the future players and coaches. Yeah.
So when you're going in 93 now, do you remember it like it was yesterday, so to speak? And who was like your roomie on there, your first roomie?
I roomed in 93, I actually roomed most of the time with Rory Underwood. And anyone who knows Rory Underwood, the England winger, the whole idea of the Lions is you don't room with an Englishman. But I got lumbered with Rory. Now, Rory doesn't drink. He doesn't touch a drop.
Yes, that'd be a good crack.
And, yeah, he's tucked up in bed at 10 o'clock in the evening, sort of thing like that. I, on the other hand, was at every night drunk. He'd have to tip me into the room, sort of thing like that. He'd wake me up in the morning with a cup of tea and stuff like that. Got me on to training on time, got me dressed and all this. It was the best roomie. It was the best roomie. Yeah. So I think that first Lions tour that I went on was about 12 weeks. About six of those weeks, I roomed with Rawls because he was a room master. And I said, I think I should room with you again, Rawls. Yeah, he's brilliant, nice. And it was just fantastic. But the tour itself, I mean, that was most probably the last. Even 97 had changed that bit. It was still amateur in fun and stuff like that, but we was far more professional. In 93, it was absolute carnage.
I remember that tour, because didn't Inga Tuigamala run into Martin Johnson and just sort of end him? It was a massive run, but I remember that moment, definitely.
most probably don't. I'm going to say...
Jace was drunk at that point.
No. See, I mean, from our point of view, our coaching mantra at that time would be, well, what do you see? I see three of them. Go for the one in the middle. That's most probably... Because we were on the smash all the time. It was... And we did laugh at one point. We only had one or two Irishmen in our team. We didn't see him for the first 3 weeks of the tour. It was... How the Irish can find an Irish bar anywhere in the world, I don't know. I always tell one story that we went out once... A true mixture. So it was Gavin Hastings, who was the captain. Scotty Gibbs was there. I was there. Nick Popperwell, the Irish prop.
Yeah.
And we were in Rotorua. And if anyone's been to Rotorua because of the volcanoes, the activity there in Oise, it's a bit hard on the nose and stuff like that. And we're in this hotel. And we said, right, come on, drop your bags in. All four of us. Go out for a quick pint. So he said to the guy at the front door, so he said, where's your nearest pub? And he went, pub. He goes, there's a bottle shop down there. And I said, what, an off licence? He goes, yeah, but you can drink in there. That was the nearest pub. So we go, right, okay, we're going there. But to go down there, you walked out of the hotel literally for about at least sort of nearly a mile. And then at the lights at the T-junction, you chucked a right. And it was about another nearly mile down there. And once you get in there, it was fine, and they was looking after us, so great hosts, and we're having a blast in there. But of course, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. Gavin, being captain, goes, I think we should make a move now. Right, okay. So we come out of the off licence, and the thought of walking sort of a mile back and then a mile back up that road to the hotel that you can see at the top of the hill, Gavin had the bright idea. He said, well, why don't we just cut across the field? Because look, we'll just cut straight across there, it'd be half it. Great, lovely. And of course, you've got nothing, but it's literally moonlight and the stars to guide you. And as we walk through this farmer's field, trying to avoid cap hats or whatever it would be and all this, all of a sudden we come to it's no word of a lie, you can only call it a ravine. And it's huge, and you're half pissed. So the first thing you do is you take a couple of steps back and you think, right, have a little run at it and jump. And you're like, I ain't going to make that. I ain't going to make that. So you look to your left and there's no bridge, and you look to your right and there's no bridge. So what do you do? And it was Gavin who started this off. He goes, all right, I know what we'll do. And he picks up a pebble. He picks up a pebble, find out how deep it is. So we're all standing there on the edge of this ravine. Gavin Hastings, our captain, throws his pebble into this ravine, and we're all standing there waiting to hear either a splash or it to hit the bottom of the ravine. Don't hear a thing. So what do you do? You find a bigger pebble. That's what you do. So Scotty Gibbs fan saying it's mostly about the size of a brick. So he tosses it in there. Still nothing. Poppy goes away and he finds something like a little sort of little ball, water polo ball or something like that. not as big as a football, little smaller one. He throws that in there. Still no splash. So I find this great big moss-covered rock, and it takes all my strength to get this rock to the edge of this ravine. And I remember even saying at the time, saying, and we're all there literally waving around like sort of MFI wardrobe, sort of like we're all that pissed. And I said, this bastard's going to make a splash, I tell you that now. So I remember tipping this moss-covered rock into this ravine. And before I knew it, all of a sudden, this silver chain link come whizzing past me. I'm even then thinking, what the bloody hell's that? And this chain link's vzz, 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 vzz. I'm thinking, what's that? And then at the end of the chain link was a bah, and this goat went. That's a true story. I'm a city kid. I don't know farmers tether things to goats to fucking rocks and stuff like that.
That's his prize ram, that was, Jase.
And that bastard didn't make a splash either.
I didn't see that coming, I've got to say. So you fast forward to 97.
Oh, the best tour.
And that was the one, because of Living With Lions, because of the DVD, that was the one, that was the tour. So, you know, watching that as a youngster growing up, that was just, must have watched that 100 times. And we'll ask about that tour now, because it looked just fantastic. But I was lucky enough to be coached by Ian McGeechan for a couple of years at Bath towards the end, and you know Geach very, very well. And it's this story that somebody reminded me of earlier, before you arrived, Jase. But I remember Geach effectively dropping me one day, play against Quinns, actually, we're dropping you this week. He didn't say that. He said, we're going to take you out the firing line or something, what they say. We're going to take, he didn't. He said, we're going to take you out this week because you look old. And I was like, you look a bit. And I said, just say it. He said, you've been shit for 3 weeks. I said, yeah, I know. And Geach is just a great human being. And he was like, I'm going to take you out for a bit, give you a couple of weeks off. But he said, you got two choices on how you react to that. And I said, it's bullshit. I should be playing. I should definitely be playing. Even though Nathan Catt should definitely have been playing for the last 2 or 3 years that I was playing. I would argue my point, even though I didn't believe it. And he said, you've got two choices to react. You either react like you're unhappy and you do that sort of stuff, and you go chinning people in training and well done. You're not playing anyway. You're definitely not playing the next two games. Or you do what Jason Leonard would do, which is whether he's playing, he helps everyone else. And if he's not playing, he helps everyone else. That sort of stuff. And we had this little chat about it, and we started talking about Lions and this guy and that guy, and this guy was perfect, this guy wasn't so perfect. And I don't want to embarrass you, Jase, but Geach knows everyone, and he's coached everyone, and he described you as the greatest British Lion he ever selected to go on a tour. And that isn't just about playing well in test matches, is it? It's not just about playing well midweek and at weekends, but actually there's a lot more to it on a tour like that when you're a senior player like you were.
I think that a Lions tour is different because of the nature of it and how people come together, the four nations come together. And it's you leave your ego and, to a certain degree, you leave your nationality at the door. And I always remember Geach saying that once, saying, OK, you are an Englishman, you are a Scotsman, you are an Irishman, you are a Welshman. But once you walk in this room, you're a British and Irish Lion. You leave your nationality at the door. That is quite important. And again, I suppose I believe in the Lions. I believe what it's about. And if you ever look at the tours, and again, the Lions should really, by rights, never ever win because they don't have enough prep time. They don't have enough time together. You can still have major cracks in the squad where people. It does take a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've kicked lumps out of people for 4 years, and then you've got to come back together as a team and actually support the bloke that you've been kicking for 4 years. You're like, oh, sometimes that's quite tough to do. So, no, I believe in the Lions and what it's about, and Geach does as well. I mean, if you cut Geach in half, I mean, he is just bleeding Lions colours, really, to be quite honest.
With that tour as well, because it was such a special tour, was it because of the stuff you did team building wise with the squad, or was it just you had an amazing group of players that sort of brought the team together? Because you've not seen a squad like that in the Lions videos we've seen.
No, I'd mostly say we did do a lot of team building, but that was just great fun and mucking around and stuff like that. It was the squad. And I think Geach, again, the selection of the squad, that's most probably key to it as well.
Yeah.
But it was not just the players at the time that... I mean, even in 93, Jeff Probyn should have gone, but he got voted against because at the time there was meant to be too many Englishmen in the squad. So it was still political in that aspect.
How could you not take Probes on that?
Well, no, he was by far the best tight end in the championship. All the English lads wanted to get rid of Will Carlin, to be quite honest. We could have got rid of Will and brought over Probes.
And Will had the arse to play in the front row, just
he
not
did,
the bottle.
The face,
yeah,
on the face. And I think that's where Geach was, and Fran and Jim Telfer were very, very good. That not only did we pick a very strong players, a group of players from England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales, we also picked, if you remember, a number of rugby league boys coming back into the game.
That's right, yeah.
And they all contributed as
Ben
well.
Bentos, Tate.
He's still living off that one bloody try.
He bloody is, yes.
Every single time I see him, I'm there going, that's 25 years ago, mate. Like that, he's going, mate.
One run, one try.
Exactly, one run, one try, that's it. You had Alan Tate.
Yeah.
You had Scotty Quinnell come back as well. Scotty Gibbs coming back.
Yeah.
And actually, one of them that was most probably... doesn't get the recognition that should have done, Alan Bateman, because he was fantastic in helping everyone else, very much in the Lions ethos that you were talking about earlier. Even though he wasn't there, obviously you're looking at Jerry Gaskett and you're looking at Scotty Gibbs, Bateman pushed them all the way through that tour.
I bet
brilliant.
Jerry was brilliant, though, off the field, helping all the other players. I'm joking.
He never used to do team
runs.
We love
Jerry.
Is that right? He never did team runs? He just walked through a team run like the day before you actually play
Jerry
a game?
Jerry did what he wanted because he was better than everyone else.
Just given situations.
Jerry is one of these ones. He's a very strange one. He's one of my best mates. And very early on in my career, everyone used to call him Joan Armour Trading in the England side. And I'm there going, why are you calling him Joan Armour Trading? He's going,
well,
me myself and I. That's the reason why. Something like that. And then with Jerry, I walk through town, I'm going up in a tube or going up an escalator or something. I'll always get someone tap me on the back and just say, excuse me, Mr. Leonard, I was at a function last night with one of your colleagues. And I go, oh, yeah, who's that? Jerry Gaskett. And I go, oh, yeah. And all of a sudden, this bloke lets rip. God, he was rude, he was this, he was that, and blah, 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 really arrogant and all this. And I go, yeah, okay. Can I just say one thing? And the bloke goes, yeah, what's that? I said, he's one of my best friends.
Yeah.
And you see this bloke's face just drop. I said, mate, it's all right, it's all right. I know what you mean. It's okay. But he's not like that, really. He's not like that at all. But on those sort of things, Jerry has, and he's very fixed about it, he won't do anything more than he has to do. If he's ready for it, he's ready. He'll go, what do I need to do anymore? I'm ready to play the game. I don't need to do any more warming up. There's a great story with England years ago, and it would have been just before. Did you come down? You come down and done some of the Limpston stuff with us, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
So when we went down to Limpston with the Marines, so Clive got us all in there, and it was also sold to Clive as well about not only just doing this, but the Marines assess men on a daily basis. And they assess men, and this is where the energy sapper come out as well.
Oh, yeah.
So it was, you've got leaders. So the Marines find leaders. Who can lead men? So you've got leaders. And then they use the saying, like, I think it was like worker bees. So guys who don't want any responsibility, but will just, if you say run at that brick wall, they'll run at that brick wall, sort of thing. Like people like Danny Grucott and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So people like...
punch a hole in that, yes, sir.
Yeah. And then the last one was energy sappers. And Clive was sitting in with the major at the time, a lovely fella called Major Adam Malinieu. And he said, Clive, what we will do is we'll assess your leaders, your worker bees and your energy sappers. Energy sappers are people that are always negative and they drain energy away from the team, from the unit and stuff like that, always negative. Clive was all over it like a rash. Yeah, lovely, brilliant, can't wait. So we did our training there, and it was hard training. So we're getting up in the morning, doing all the weights and the fitness, getting up then doing the marine stuff, doing rugby sessions in the afternoon. And then most nights we're doing night excursions and stuff like that. And sort of you've got to capture the opposition's flag. And one night Austin Healey got held hostage and we beat the shit out of him. I think we beat the shit
that
out of him.
That was after training.
And everyone was, all the Marines are going, don't you want to find a flag? No, I don't care.
And then at the end of all this, so Major Adam Molyneux sits down with Clive, and he's got this book there. Clive's here, opened up his book. He's gone, right, go on, tell me. What have I got? He said, Clive, he said, you've got an array of leaders. You've got Johnson, you've got Delalio, you've got Leonard, you've got Back, you've got Dawson, you've got all these players. He said, look, you've got leaders coming out your ears. And, of course, Clive's scribbling away, going, great, great, great. What about worker bees? Oh, have a look at Richard Hills, Cockrells, Danny Grucotts. You've got loads of them as well. And so Clive's scribbling all this way. He goes, so what about energy sappers? And Major Adam Molyneux says, you've only got one energy sapper in your whole squad. He goes, it's so unusual. That doesn't normally happen. You've only got one. And Clive went straight away. He goes, great, lovely. Who is it? Who is it? He's gone. He's out of the squad straight away. He went, it's Jerry Gasquet. Clive just shut his book like that, and he went, can't get rid of him, he's my best player. And he just...
exactly.
Every team has sappers, don't they? Every team. They go for sappuccinos with their mates. There's one in Wales, Gethin Jenkins, right? He's the grumpiest bloke ever. So we saw
him the other week in the street, didn't we? And he actually smiled. Like, he spoke to us for about 3-4 minutes in the street in Cardiff. Yeah. It was a fake smile, but he tried, didn't he?
He did. So it was like a wedding smile. And
he hates people. Hates all of you, hasn't met you yet.
2005, right, Wales, we beat Ireland in the last game, okay, to win a Grand Slam. And it's not been won in Wales for years and years, 20-odd years. And we're in the change room after, right, and we're all, like, excited and we're all over the moon. You know, it's amazing. And I look at Mellon, and Mellon just sat there like you, just like this. I say, mate, what's up? And he just goes, oh, mate. Think how long it's going to take to get out of the stadium tonight. And you're thinking, mate, you've scored a great try. You've charged down Ron O'Gara, which was down to me because I lose the ball in contact. Not many people know that, all right? Try assist, second
must
one
have
of the day.
That one.
But every team has sappers, don't they? But just going back to his point, you know, you went to the Marines training. Weren't you meant to be the next Jason Leonard?
Yeah. There's still time, mate. I was, one of the questions we actually got on Twitter was for Jace was, when did you realise Flats wasn't going to be? Thing is, what happens is you got a legend like Jace, and what you don't ever want is to be compared to someone. It's like someone runs quick next week and they say, do you reckon you're going to be the new Usain Bolt? No, I'm not. So I knew I had a chance of being a half-decent player. I was a cocky little twat, but I tried my best and I was tried hard in games, that sort of stuff. I didn't think I was any better than I was. I knew I had a reasonable chance of getting some England caps, but I just knew that with the people that were around were getting injured less than me, more robust, more talented, and probably more professional. So I just knew that. But for the first couple of years of my career, it was like, this guy's the next Jason Leonard, this guy's the next Jason Leonard. Then they stopped writing it. I blame politics and injuries. That's all it was. That's the only things it was.
I actually remember the moment when that actually happened, and that was... your first cap was, we've spoken about this before, against South Africa, in South Africa in 2000, where I had a rush of blood. And there, it was a close game. Their fly half was a guy called Van Straam, very similar to a Wilkinson, very Wilkin-esque, sort of like literally kicking over goals. Big tackler as well, and he's a bit of a thug as well. He's a bit of a dirty player. And we were underneath their posts. Not much in this game, just before half-time, 5 minutes before half-time, Van Straam come over and killed the ball. I had the rush of blood, and I've just come in with both knees, and I've knee-dropped him in the back, in the bottom of the back, small of the back.
I remember it so well.
And I've heard him squeal. And the referee, Stuart Dickinson, from Australia, standing there, and he's blown the whistle, and he's gone. And he's a nice guy. He's a really nice guy, this ref. And he went like that. He said, I'm sorry, Jess. Mate, that's right in front of me. So then he goes, I'm gonna have to send you to the bin. And I went, well, if you would have blown your whistle when he actually came off his feet and was killing the ball, I wouldn't have done it, would I? So then like that. And he said, no, sorry, mate, you've got to go to the bin. So now, so
could have been read that, JC.
Yeah, could have been
bad.
Could have been. It was that bad. So that gave Flats his chance to come on the pitch because obviously replacement for a prop, sort of thing like that. So at half time, we're in the change room and Clive's going round and ripping everyone to pieces because the first. test we played against South Africa in 2000 over there. We narrowly lost. Remember when Tim Stimpson, the ball bounced up, he tried to grab it in midair and ground it, and Andre Vos took him out in midair. It was the first time it went to a video ref, and it was a local video ref that was doing it, and funny enough, it didn't come our way, something like that. Yeah. And it was one of these ones. Clive's just gone round the room. You're playing crap, and you're playing rubbish, and you're playing this, that, and the other. It gets to me, and I'm sitting next to Lowell there, and he goes, and I can't believe it. My most experienced player has just produced the most blatant bit of thuggery I've ever seen in my life. That was absolutely disgusting. That could have lost the game for us. And then he's gone round the room having a go at other people. And I'm sitting next to Lowell, and I went, why is he having a go at me? And Lowell went, JC, it was pretty bad. It was pretty blatant. And I went, well, I don't know about that. I've just won this game for England. And Lowell looked at me and he went, how do you think that? And I went, because that coming out for the second half, I can tell you that now. And he didn't come out for the second half, and we won.
Yeah, he did it, yeah.
And but that night, so we won the second test. And fair play to Clive, he said, go and let off some steam and all this. And this is where I knew you were up against it. Is the next
in selection terms?
In the next morning, we all get woken up. Wake up. Emergency meeting, all this. Wake up. So you're there, and you've had a late night sort of thing like that, and you finish in the early hours of the morning. You sort of come down into the meeting room. You're sort of like completely, this is not the norm sort of thing like that. It's day after an international, so you should have a bit of a lay in or quiet day and all this. All summer there, and there's Clive, and I'm still wiping the sleep out of my eyes. I've only got in sort of half an hour or whatever earlier or something like that. And Clive's gone into one. And fair play to Clive. He's just gone, right. He goes, we have three issues, and I want them sorted. And I want them sorted by you lot. He said, first one. And he goes, and I'll start off with what I think is the least serious. He goes, we were staying in the cliff in Joburg. It's cut out of a cliff, this hotel. So to get up the top, you need golf buggies. And he said, right, someone came in late last night and obviously has forgotten or just didn't even bother to put their handbrake on. So a golf buggy has gone all the way down the mountain and it's currently sitting in the bedroom of room 121. So it's actually smashed through the wall and it's sitting in the bedroom. He goes, I want to find out who was driving that buggy. So you're like, okay, that's the first one. He goes, secondly, he goes, there's an irate father in the reception claiming that his 18-year-old daughter's been kidnapped. And I'm sitting there going, and this is only number two. This is only number two. So Clive's gone, please find his daughter and return her to the father in the reception. So I'm there going, I can't wait to see, what's number three? But number three was, he said, when Nelson Mandela was obviously brought out of incarceration in Robben Island, he actually stayed in the cliff as part of his rehabilitation back into life. And he was so taken by everyone and this. So he actually went and bought, or on behalf of the government, when he became president, this fantastic decanter that was worth, I mean, not thousands, I mean, tens and tens and tens of thousands. And not only did he just buy that, he filled it up with Napoleonic brandy or something like that. So it was worth another tens and tens of thousands of this. But then also had it inscribed, a silver thing around it. But actually, and it's signed by Nelson Mandela in this silver. And he said, this sits pride of place in the hotel behind reception. At basically 5 o'clock this morning, it's been stolen. I want you to find that decanter. So we've all gone off like rats. And I'm with Lowell. And I said to Lowell, I said, right, I'll go sort out the... I'll go sort out the buggy. You go sort out the other two. So he went knocking. I found the buggy. We still couldn't find out, honestly, if it was... We thought it was Matt Dawson and Austin Healey, or it could have been you and Gruy. But we got the golf cart out and all this and that. So we sorted it all out. And all of a sudden, I saw Lawrence. So Lawrence said he went round. So you're looking round the room to say, who wasn't in here today? Who wasn't in the meeting? Sort of thing like. And it became blatantly obvious that Flats wasn't there, and neither was Danny Grucott. So I think Lowell sort of knocked on the door, sort of said, on the room that they're sharing as well, and sort of opens the door. What's up? And Lowell's gone, right, first of all, she's got to go back to the reception. And secondly, have you seen the decanter? And I think Gruy's saying, oh, I don't know about a decanter. And I think Lovell's gone, what's that on the bedside cabinet over there? But the problem with it, the decanter was in one piece, which was fine. Not one drop of Napoleon brandy that was in it. So did you have to actually get some tea bags and fill it up again?
Oh, shit, Jason, honestly. Firstly, all right, firstly, you can't drink the tap water there because you're in Joburg. And the bar was shut, so couldn't get any bottled water. So the Napoleonic brandy was all we had for survival. And when Jace rightly called this person an 18-year-old girl, I was only 20 though, so it wasn't as bad as it sounds. I'm 38 now, but I wasn't 38 then. I was only 20. And anyway, define kidnap. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of
It's loose. No. Actually, now thinking about it, I do remember why the father thought it was kidnapped. Don't you remember? Because I think her car had a sunroof and someone threw her bag out the sunroof.
Shit, yeah. Also,
that's why the father thought she was kidnapped, because her handbag was on the motorway, N64.
Yeah, they technically found some ID on the M2, whatever it was. I mean, it was an accident. Anyway, that was Julian White, not me. There's a lot of stuff went on that night. But basically, yeah, the million details you could add to it, but you don't need to because that's perfect. But when Lawrence came to find me and Danny in our room, he knocked on the door and I opened the door completely innocently, thinking someone's banging hard on the door, must be. So I opened the door, and the first thing Lawrence says was, "What the fuck are you wearing?" And I was wearing all of her clothes. So I was like, first tour, 20. And my dad, who'll be listening to this, sorry, Dad, my dad, who is a psychologist, a child psychologist, this is honestly what he said. So I spoke to my dad before we went on tour, you know, because I had a mobile phone, but I couldn't use it from country to country, too expensive, that sort of stuff. And my dad just said, please, please don't fuck it up. And I was just standing there thinking of my dad, thinking, oh, shit, this is it. This is it.
You, anyway. You did marry very young, though, didn't you? 20. I remember the first tour as well, your first tour, because he came back and we'd go like to Bluestone shopping. And
That's the one.
And Lakeside. Is it Lakeside as well?
Yeah.
And he'd be flat out in England tracksuit. Like, just go and shop it. Top to toe, go and shop it.
Shanks used to do, like, when he did with press, because he was going over to Wales then and all the press, and he relentlessly called me Darren Flatman in all the interviews. Because they're like, sir, how's training? I live with Darren Flatman. I didn't ask who you live with, mate. Never heard of him. And it was Darren Flatman, until one day the Western Daily Mail or whatever it was printed Tom Shanklin's prop Darren Flatman. It was the best day of Shanks's life. He cut it out and put it on our notice board in Stoke Newington.
The like, best thing up. We went about living together was, I can't believe he actually asked me. He had to ring his mum to ask her how to cook a bacon sandwich. Like,
that's actually true. That's actually a joke.
Look at the size of you.
Yeah, I know. But
how do you know how to cook?
I ate a lot of bacon sandwiches. I just didn't cook them. I didn't cook them. Unfortunately, I wasn't the best prepared human being for the real world when I landed in it. But it was all right because I lived with, among other people, when I first joined Saracens, I lived with Paoli, who you met earlier, who's the world's most resourceful man. He's like, you know, top Boy Scout.
MacGyver.
Yeah, and I also live with George Shooter. Lots of you will know who George Shooter is. Played hooker for England 40-odd times, played for Tigers and Saris for years and Tigers for years. And I live with George, and George is a deeply, deeply weird human being. His eyes are too close together. He's got like one of those comedy noses you buy at the shop. He's got that, always waiting for him to take it off. But he cooked every night and cleaned all the dishes and did everything. He hated me and Dave Thompson, who now handles all the recruitment at Bath. There were the three of us sort of lived together, and he absolutely hated us. George is like proper alpha, aggressive, doesn't talk, plays computer games with the curtains off on his days off. And he was like the funniest guy in the world at the club. He was crazy. Georgie was crazy, wouldn't he? Get him home, he hates everyone, shuts the curtains. So I sort of grew up with that, but I didn't have to feed myself. So I finally ended up, he came back one day, by the way, this is complete tangent. But George used to hate, I won't say what it was inappropriate, you can't use a language these days, but I remember him coming home, and the day he finally lost his temper with me and Tomo was when he came home from training, and we were upstairs under his duvet eating Haagen-Dazs watching a film. George lost the fucking plot, he went absolutely mad. He tore up the duvet, and it was his job to mow the lawn, and he went mad in this room because he was sick of us being so soft. And he looked out there, and it was his job to mow the lawn. And we'd gone out there early without him. We weren't allowed to mow the lawn because it's George's job. And we'd just done a big, like, knob with balls in the lawn. George went absolutely apeshit. He went so mad that he smashed the electricity meter off the wall and everything. He hated us. I think he likes us now.
I think we'll take a short break now. Yep. We like to have a on break that. on a high on a story about mowing grass. So have a 5-minute break. Go to the toilet, get a drink in, and we'll come back in a little while. Thank you.
Right, while Flats has just whizzed off, still with that IBS problem, I think, it is Bet of the Week time, and this week we will be betting on Six Nations. So, we are going to go for the France v Ireland game, and we are betting Ireland to win in Stade de France by 6 points or more. So get on it. Terms and conditions do apply. All the money that we raise during these bets go to children in need. Good luck to you.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back to part two, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey. Oh, Token House, welcome back.
I've got to bring you down to bring you back up.
We're in the Token House. Works. We're in a tug now, so we're all going to feel really funny now since Shank said that. Jesus Christ. So we're going to ask you guys in a minute to stick your hands up if you want to. We've got Powley over there on the roaming mic. We got a load of questions from email. We've got a load of questions on social media we can rattle through. But before we do that, before we go to the questions, Paolo, because Paolo's got one for me straight away, we're just going to quickly, before we get onto that, we're going to talk to Jason quickly about the World Cup in 2003. And it was something that everyone in the room except you watch from a distance. Tell us a little bit about the... Because obviously we talked about sort of 93 Lions and the dynamic in that squad. I'm guessing while you guys are very tight, it was a very different vibe in 2003 because things got pretty serious pretty quick. So what was the kind of dynamic like? What was that group like? And ultimately, did winning that World Cup change your life is something that always interests me.
I don't know about it. Yeah, it must in some aspect, most probably changing your life that bit. I think you just become recognisable. I mean, even with the body shape and stuff like that. But yeah. Then people, I always remember the first, after the Rugby World Cup, when we come back, there was a rake of dinners. So I think Lawrence Dallaglio had a couple, Neil Back had a couple, Dorian West had a couple. Matt Dawson had a couple of testimonial dinners and all this. So you're always going at a black tie dinner and all this. And I always remember walking into one of them and there's a husband and wife, there's black tie bash. And this husband stopped me with his missus next to him. He said, "Mr. Leonard, I just want to shake your hand. Thank you for the best day of my life." And literally his wife has stood next to him and just smashed him on the sort of arm and the chest. And he's gone, what? And she's turned around, she's gone, "What about our wedding day? And what about the birth of our two beautiful daughters?" And he went, "Darling, I'm so sorry. And he's still shaking my hand. He said, "As I said, the best day of my life." So,
So I was in the domestic straight away. So then I like, I think that's most probably what, again, what it means to other people and stuff. That's the game changer, and people will always know where they was. Some people were hiding behind a couch. Some people had to take the dog for a walk and stuff like that because it was so fraught and stuff. I mean, but that group was quite tight for different reasons. With the Lions, we'd gone through hard times together, winning games, losing games. We lost Grand Slams along the way. People forget that they talk about the Grand Slam of 2003 and then that two-year run into the World Cup, beating Australia, beating New Zealand away, South Africa in 2000, and then the games. And it was a little bit like it was ours to lose to a certain degree.
Did it feel like that? Did you feel confident that you were going to go and win it?
Yeah we did. And that's not cocky. We'd beaten everybody in that sort of 18 months. So there wasn't anyone there that we felt particularly worried about on our day. And I mean, all rugby's like that, on your day. But for me, I think if you have a look at the makeup of that squad, we had certain players lost family, lost kids. So there was bigger things going on than just rugby. Family were ill and stuff like that at the time. And that squad pulled together and helped our mates. It was one of that. So it wasn't just the rugby and the games and the highs and lows. It's what's going on in people's personal lives as well and stuff like that. And it was tight. And I mean, even as you say, you're still having fun. I mean, there's a great one, that 2003 game down at the Millennium Stadium, where we played the game, but the function was back at the stadium. So we went back to the St. David's Hotel.
Yeah.
And come back into town afterwards. Now, if anyone knows Cardiff after an international, it's like the Wild West. It's like the Wild West. And it's great fun. And I did sort of question whoever decided to do this, why do this? Because we're going through Cardiff now in a massive traffic. So you're not moving. You're most probably moving about 3 miles an hour. We've got this bus that has got this great big rose and fucking England written all the way down the side of it. So once you go past Chip Alley, you're getting nothing but bags of chips and kebabs and everything's being thrown at the bus. And we're getting abused in this, that and the other. And I always remember sort of Neil Back next to me. There was one bloke abusing Neil Back about something or other. And Neil Back's just looking at him going, "How big's your dick? Is it that big? Is it that big?" Sort of, and this bloke's going mad. And then some bloke started playing chicken with the bus. And he's playing, he's jumping in front of the bus, he's jumping out of the way of the bus, he's jumping in front of the bus, he's jumping out of the bus, sort of thing like this. But what he didn't realise, because he's obviously pissed, this bus has got great big overhanging sort of wing mirrors like this. And about the third or fourth time he did it, fucking smash straight into his wing mirror.
Night, night.
This bloke's on the floor, there's claret everywhere. So we've all pulled off the bus.
Yeah.
We've all pulled off the bus. And it's not very often you see Martin Johnson as the calm, collected one. So he's trying to calm everyone down and going, "Look, mate, come here," and all this. And his mate's pissed, going, "He did that on purpose." He's going, "Did it on purpose? He's been playing chicken with a fucking bus for 8 times." So then I didn't do it on purpose and this and the other. I'm standing there. Jono's trying to get everyone back on the bus. Like, guys, calm down. Look, we don't want an incident. Calm down. I'm standing over this bloke who's now got claret all over his face, laying on the floor. And I'm going, "Did that hurt? That looked like if that hurt. Did that hurt? Did that hurt?" Something like that. And it was just one of these ones. But like funny things like that. Yeah. You actually still remember that. That night, Johnny Wilkinson didn't want to come out for a beer because he went, "What, after the carnage that has just been before the dinner? Like, not in a million years." I went, "No, everyone's gone back now. So it would just be Cardiff. It'd be fine." We went out and we had a great night. We went to a couple of the bars. Everyone, again, appreciated the game and stuff like that. And that's what makes those games special. Yeah, the win and stuff like that, but the memories that go with it as well and stuff like that. And we had, during that season, that 18 months, I'm pretty sure you could remember something of each game and afterwards and the beers and the camaraderie and the crack and stuff like that. And that went all the way through to the World Cup in 2003. I mean, I still laugh that all the Aussie press that used to hate us used to stand as we was leaving the stadiums. They'd all stand on the corner of where the exit is for the buses for the players. And of course they're all calling us Dad's Army and all this. And literally as we get past, we'd all start singing, "Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler? If you think old England's done." And we'd be blasting out, and you can see the English press on this side pissing themselves laughing.
Yeah.
All the Australian on this side going, "What's so funny about that? What's so funny about that?"
One thing that always interests me was, I was a very young kid and I got to come for a test week with the England team, right? There was no club game at Sarries. So you were playing and Vix was playing and I think Phil Greening was playing and John O'Neill's guys, whatever, playing against Ireland at Twickenham. And I knew, of course, Paul Wallace was playing and he was recently back from the Lions and he was being called the best tight head in the world. He probably was at that point or close to it. And I remember just being... I wasn't playing. I was unbelievably nervous. And if you'd got injured, I still wouldn't have been playing. I was just there to learn the ropes, you know, and see what it was like. And being on the bus, I was unbelievably nervous. I've never been nervous my whole, you know, ever since I started playing as a kid. And I remember thinking, God, bloody hell, how does Jace do it? How does he cope with these nerves and that sort of stuff? And I remember looking at you on the bus and he just winked at me and said, all right, son. I said, yeah, but I thought you were calm as that. And then Phil Vickery walked past and I was about, I said, sort of after you, Vicks. He goes, no, go on, boy, after you, mate, you know. Sort of super chill. This is like hour and 20 minutes before kickoff. And I was blown away by it. And I've always wondered, you wake up on World Cup final day, and I know you've got a ton of caps by then, you had a ton of caps by the World Cup final, but you wake up on that day, are you bricking it? Are you looking forward to it? Are you looking forward to it, excited, or is it just another Saturday and it's time for breakfast?
You're not bricking it. I'd say you're looking forward to it. You're excited by it. You're not worried. It's definitely not another day. That's for sure. Because of the late kickoff, you had a big lay-in as well. So that's some people still get up very early. I was here fine. No, you have a big lay-in because it's a long day, sort of thing like that. Meetings were all fine. It was pretty calm and relaxed. I always laugh with Clive. Me and Clive had a deal. I was 36 at the time and our warm-ups for games were getting longer and longer. We had a great fitness guy called Dave Redding. And obviously, great nickname, Otis. I mean, that was really well thought through, that, weren't it, Otis Redding? But this guy was brilliant and absolutely fantastic. And actually, most probably one of the unsung heroes within that, along with the coaches and all this. But he was brilliant for us. And all our warm-ups for these games now were getting longer and longer. It started off, it would be a half an hour warm-up. Then it was 45 minutes. Then it was getting up to about just under an hour. And I remember saying to Clive before the World Cup, I said, Clive, I've got to have a word about these warm-ups. And he went, what's that? I said, look, I'm 36 years of age. I can do the warm-up or I can do the game. I can't do both. And fair play to Clive. He just went, Jace, you do what you want to do. So then like that. So you do all the warm-ups and you go, right, OK, great, lovely, I'm done. Thanks. Doing a little bit of a Jerry. And literally, you see the guys, well, you know, no, I'm done. I'm fine. I'm just going to go back in the changing room now. No, fine. Brilliant. Like that.
Let you do that. It's nice.
Yeah, let you do it. So, but was there any nerves? No, not really. Jono didn't say a great deal before the game. He didn't need to. Not that he says much anyway. He don't know many words. So, and again, you're in a final. You're in a final. So there's not much that needed to be said. Most probably the big surprise for us was, which is a true story, the referee, Andre Watson, who played such a pivotal role in that final, like all referees, comes into the changing room before the game and actually says, right, this is what I want today and all this. And we actually asked him and we said, we think Australia's so weak in the forwards at scrum time, we want to take them on and we don't want you to be conned into giving penalties because the Australians at that time were very canny about being very passive and so you'd hit through the mark and they'd go backwards and everything like that. And the reason why is that they'd quite happily do that and get a free kick because they might not have got the ball anyway in their own scrum. Yeah, so yeah. We're trying to say that to the referee. And he's always been a good ref. He's very much a yes sir, no sir, three bags full ref. You don't say anything to him, even if he's just made an absolute howler in front of you, just go, good decision, sir, something like that. It's, you can't say anything to this guy because he's a proper, real disciplinarian. And he come in, he said, guys, no, he goes, I won't give away any penalties at all. He goes, I'll only give away penalties as long as I can see it and I can put my mortgage on it. That's what he said to us. So we went, great. And he actually did do that for about the first 30, maybe 40 minutes, and then it started going a bit awry after that.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And there's a true bit. So that last scrum that you see of the 80 minutes, where actually he banged Trevor Woodman for not going down in the scrum, which actually only was a free kick offence, but because he was so pissed off with Trevor Woodman, he gave him a proper penalty, sort of straight arm, so it's 3 points. But as the scrum come up, Steve Thompson, who's not the brightest of people, actually had a dig at the referee with this in the back of the mind, as in won't give away a penalty unless I can put my mortgage on it. Steve Thompson's just turned around to Andre Watson and said, tell you what, ref,
you must have a fucking shit house. And we wonder why the That's referee amazing. Weren't on our side.
That's amazing.
I don't know why.
Oh no, you played against 16.
Pauly,
we're going to come to some questions. Yeah, someone's going to sit down. We've got a load on Twitter as well. But Pauly had a question first, didn't you?
Well, no, that's more of a complaint. Do you want a complaint?
Yeah, somebody registered a complaint with Pauly.
Yeah, there was the three people at the front who were sitting in front of Shanks.
No longer
they've
there.
Moved. They're not there because he stinks of piss. cat piss, apparently.
Actually, it's funny you should mention that, Pauly. Shanks actually does smell of piss, but he smells of... he actually genuinely smells of dog piss because we were filming this thing this morning and we were over at Mike Tyndall's house, and Mike and Zara have got about 38 dogs and 37 staff and 38 dogs, and Shanks has got this lovely blue like puffer jacket that he wears around the place. He's really chuffed with it. It's quite new. He left it down and he's sitting upstairs. He's walked in from the car park earlier and he's like, something smells funny, and he takes his jacket off. He's been wearing it. It's been raining as well, so it's seeped in a little bit. And a couple of Tins' dogs are in season, and I think they're getting a bit funny about smells. And they pissed on his coat. pissed on it, and it's gone through to his shoulder, but he didn't want to take his jumper off because he thinks it ruins his look.
Thanks, Dave. Same dog that pissed in your mouth, I think.
Right, we've got a question at the back here.
Have we got any questions?
Questions,
right, guys. Just a... fascinated by the psychology of someone like Jace who's been there and done it for so long. How do you think you were motivated? Was that fear of failure, like negative motivation, or was it, fuck it, I'm going to have all this, no one can stop me type thing? How did you get to the top and stay there for so long?
Good question.
I wouldn't say fear of failure, only because I think sometimes you can become paralysed by fear like that. I know what you mean, which that is a big spur in a lot of sports people. Mine was actually a far more basic emotion that I didn't want to let anyone down. And when I say anyone down, it's your teammates, then it's your family and friends. And again, you can take that to so many different levels where you say, you remember the first teacher that made an effort and sort of took you somewhere to a trial or whatever it would be and stuff like that. You represent, if you're pulling on your national shirt or the British and Irish Lions shirt, you're representing the aspirations and the dreams of millions of people that would give their right arm to be in that shirt. And sometimes people talk about the shirt. And again, that's another emotive thing as well. When you see players, they grab the badge. Whilst, again, I think the shirt is very important. And to me, the badge is very important. The most important thing is what beats beneath the badge. If you've got a big heart there, you want players like that in your team. If you've got a small heart, you won't be playing in that team very long. And that was the most important thing for me, was making sure that I got the respect of my teammates, the respect of the opposition that you're playing against. That's what I wanted most out of the game. Win, lose or draw, it doesn't matter after that. As long as I get that, if we all play well enough, you hope you get the win. Doesn't always happen. But that's what I always, that's how I played the game. That's how I always saw myself as looking at it.
Lovely, great question as well. Yep, another one over the back there, Paolo.
Cheers. Hi. You said something interesting. Hi there.
You all right?
Oh, lost one. No, we got it. You said something interesting earlier about how failure as a Lions coach is the ultimate blot on a copybook of a coach. So given that Clive Woodward presided over the greatest Lions shit show of modern era...
He also won a World Cup, mate. He went all right.
There you go. How much of that World Cup win was down to an amazing group of players? And how much of it was down to the sort of slightly eccentric management style?
I think there is a real partnership in there. I've got to say this now, that I think with Clive in 2005, we most probably was all a little bit caught up with what happened in 2003. And again, it doesn't come around that easy. That took us 6 years, 7 years to get to that stage in 2003. Clive tried to replicate that in 6 or 7 weeks, and it wasn't going to happen. And again, as I said, you've got to look at New Zealand as the ultimate. It's not, it's different than South Africa and it's different than Australia. So I really felt for him there in that aspect. But was it a real partnership? Yeah, it was. I mean, I think sometimes we all get a little bit carried away and we look back at it with rose-tinted glasses and stuff like that, and you're thinking, oh yeah, but it was this, that and the other. Everyone played their part. That's what I would like to think in that
that 2003 players, the coaches. As I said, the one guy earlier, Dave Redding, I mean, he doesn't get that much of a mention, but he played just an instrumental part of some of the other coaches and some of the players. I mean, we had, again, and that's Clive's quirky style. We had a guy who would come in and cook food for us. We had a chef from the Pennyhill Park. Dave used to come in and do all our meals, where you think that's a little bit OTT. You go, well, actually, if you tour around the world, and someone like Martin Johnson, who's a extremely basic person in many, many ways. but Martin Johnson, on a Friday night, all he wants to eat is spaghetti bolognese. That is it. No matter where he is in the world. Now, that's not a problem when you're in Rome on a Friday night playing the Azzurri on Saturday. You're guaranteed you're going to get a good meal. If you're in Fiji and the bowl comes out and it's a tortoise shell, even though there might be spaghetti bolognese in there, it ain't going to taste the same. I can tell you that now. So the chef come in and would prepare all our food for us. All bits and little bits and pieces like that all make a difference. So we all played a part, I would say.
Bolognese should be served with tagliatelle as well, because it's a pasta that soaks up the meat.
Shut up, Shanks.
But just going back to the 05, with Clive obviously was coach of the Lions in 05, right? And he tried to do something similar to what he did with England. So with England, like, he had you guys for a long, long time. So you roomed on your own, didn't you, in the World Cup? Now, he tried to bring that into the Lions in the basis that what's the obstacle to full recovery? That's sleep. So in order to sleep well on your own, to sleep better, you sleep on your own. So we didn't room with anyone through that tour. We roomed on our own. And it's difficult with the Lions because you get a week together. So we had a week together, and then we did some great team bonding stuff. We had a canvas each, which we had to create, which formed this massive picture. And that was it. And then you go out to New Zealand and you're all rooming on your own, and it's quite boring because, you know, after you've trained, you've done your analysis, you might have watched a movie in the team, you go upstairs, and normally that's when you start to get to know each other, because, you know, have like an hour or two in your own room, bed, chatting. There's nothing at all. And I'm going to tell you, the amount of boys that needed glasses when they came back from that from that tour. Not me,
bloody
I'm fine.
Hell. Right, we got. Is it Matt at the back? Yeah. It's Matt, isn't it? We met earlier at the bar. Yeah Matt. Cheers. Hi, Matt. You look very smart. ask your question, will you?
This is specifically for Jason. As somebody who's been at the top end of the RFU, who realistically do you think could follow Eddie Jones after 2019, but also work with him?
I mean, that's quite a good question. I think all the coaches that he's got there at this moment in time, they've all got the ability to go further. Whether he'll look at bringing someone from outside in, I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea as well. I mean, at some point, you would love to see, personally, you have a look at some of our club coaches, them to get sort of dragged in on a sort of year's basis, see if they could cut it as well. Someone for me that I think is doing a fantastic job, whether he'd make the move because he's doing so well, would most probably be a Rob Baxter, to see, get him involved in that setup. He might actually say it's not for me and stuff like that. But again, you've got people like Borthers and those guys, Guzzi, they're all good coaches. It's now making sure that Eddie, in that transitional period again, Eddie finds someone that he can go, that is the person to take it forward. And that's quite a big ask. I mean, Eddie's been a success. I mean, one thing about Eddie I will say is this coming match, the Italian match, is most probably one of the tougher games he's going to have, because he's got so many injuries. He's been quite lucky. He's had injuries to world-class players like Vinopola, to Alagi. We've not seen him for a while, but he's got so many at this moment in time. So it will be a real challenge to see how they cope with the game on Sunday. I've got to say that now. And that would be a test of his character as well. But do I see them being other coaches coming in? Yeah, definitely. Maybe from outside coming in as well. But I'd still like him to be replaced by an Englishman. I've got to say that now. I really do.
I suppose the problem you've got, like, if someone like Rob Baxter takes that position and it doesn't go well, where does he go from there? You know, he's got a great job at Exeter. You know, he's going to go back down and have to start again.
And he's made no
like
secret. He's made no secret here. he's made no secret to it. I think he feels very much so that there's still a job to do at Exeter.
Yeah.
And okay, they won the Premiership the other year and they want to go on into Europe and this and the other. So again, what he'll do, Eddie's he's a character and he'll be thinking completely out of the box and stuff like that. But you could see Eddie bringing people in from outside to say, well, let's see what they if they can cut it in that international environment. And that's the skill set that I think he has. He will pick someone who will make, I think, a very good fist of it. I think he will.
And you know it's going to be someone we weren't expecting. That's what I always like about Eddie Jones, because you don't quite know what's coming next. And, you know, it'll be Boris Johnson or someone, won't it? That's all coming. It'll be like John Major, be like director of rugby.
Or his sister.
But it's a fascinating one, because it's easy to say, well, you got these three coaches, you got Guzzi and you got Neil Hatley and you got Borthers and all that, and they're great coaches and they're clearly great coaches. Look at the results and the guys say amazing things about them. So one of them deserves a promotion, and it's not about deserves all the time. It's partly to do with that, but actually it's about how different that job is, because what they do now is, I happen to know they work brutally hard, those coaches. So you think, oh, I've got 10, 12, 13 games a year, how hard can it be? Their schedules are brutal. It is very, very aggressive workload that Eddie Jones, you know, sort of demands of them. But that's fine, because they're all mega hard-working blokes. They always were. But actually what you're asking them to do in Eddie's job is a similar workload, but they effectively become, yes, they're coaches, they're analysts. They're also steering the ship. They're not just looking after their little unit. So it's much broader, which means they can't give the area they've always given the detail and the focus anymore. They have to look at other stuff. So they've got to withdraw from what they know and love best. But also, you effectively become a media personality. So I've known, you know, I know Hats and Guzzi, well, they're very effervescent guys, and Borthers is great value when you know him well. But I've known Borthers since we were kids, and he doesn't, you know, doesn't particularly enjoy all that stuff. Maybe he'd be fantastic at it if he took the job and he, whatever it was, and bought into it. But you're talking about a completely different job. So how often do you see Steve Borthwick hosting a press conference? You just don't see it. Because Eddie might say to him, do you want to do it? And he'll say, no, thanks. Doesn't want the fame, doesn't want the attention, doesn't want the profile, just happy to work his ass off without anyone seeing or knowing about it. And you're becoming a public figure, you know, so it's more than just who's a good enough coach. It's public speaking, it's handling the media, and it's a completely different world. So it was a fascinating time. Yes, mate.
Could be you.
So Jason mentioned earlier transition from 93 to 97 in terms of professionalism. Question for all three of you. Who's the person who had the shittest attitude to training, to diet, to, you know, whatever, but still managed to cut it on a Saturday afternoon?
Well, I guess, Jace, I guess in the amateur days, there would have been a greater number of lads who were just mega talented. But, of course, when everyone's pro and everyone's in mega shape and they're brilliant at defending and they're training full-time to stop people playing well, things get tougher for those players who haven't put the work in. I mean, there are always some. I mean, there are mega pros that everyone knows about. So the guys like, you know, just playing at sort of, you know, someone like Lawrence. All right, Lawrence likes a night out, but fuck, did he train? You know, did he train unbelievably hard? And I remember watching, I was injured and watching fitness training, and it was the second rows and back rows, and you got Jono, massive bloke. You know, not he wouldn't be brilliant in the gym or anything like that, but massive bloke, absolutely flat out at the front of fitness. You know, and you've got Neil Back, who is just an absolute machine. Richard Hill, machine. These sorts of guys. But there is the odd guy, I expect, that just gets by. But there aren't. I wouldn't say there are too many at the top of the game now that don't work their asses off.
Not in the professional. In the amateur era, yeah. I mean, the one that would spring to mind would be Dean Richards. I mean, Dean Richards was world-class, one of the best number eights that you'll ever get. But his idea of a warm-up before a game would literally, he would go into the toilet with the programme and have a dump. He would come back out, he would literally throw the programme on the floor, he would bend over, touch his toes three times, and he'd go, great, that's it, I'm ready. That was it. But he would still go out and play absolutely amazing. But it's also the stuff that you don't see, that's the other side of it as well. So that might be the warm-up, but Dino used to train, or he used to tell us he used to train.
But you know, but there will always be guys that are naturally gifted, genetically gifted or whatever. But what happens is people like you and I will watch games and we will say, well, he's talking about he or she, they're just genetically gifted, they're naturally gifted, natural talent. And I always think, well, that's definitely true of a lot of players. It's also an insult to a lot of players. So if you look at the current England team, you've got Anthony Watson, guaranteed first choice Lions player. The genetics on that guy are crazy. But what you don't see is that he's not just a born athlete who's luckily really good, works his arse off. So you pop in and do the odd feature for the telly and you see these guys training and you see them in the gym 45 minutes before the gym session starts, priming their bodies to lift weights. They're doing 45 minutes prep to lift weights for 30 minutes. Then they're having a rest and they're drinking this and taking this and they're prepping to go on the field and run. It's relentless. It's absolutely relentless. And guys like Cipriani, Danny Cipriani, who splits opinion in terms of his personality or whatever, but as a player, it kind of doesn't split opinion, really. In attack, at least, he doesn't split opinion. Wonderful, wonderful player. But what people look at him and say, well, he's got the talent, hasn't got the attitude. So you speak to guys, whether they like him or not, pretty much, I've never heard anyone say he isn't one of the hardest trainers I've ever seen. Absolutely trains his arse off. And you look at the rig on him, you know, look at the shape on him. He trains unbelievably hard. And guys like Ollie Barkley, that I played with for years and played, whatever, 30-odd times for England, whatever it was, at 10 and 12, known for being a bit of a lad on the piss and a bit, you know, loose here and there, unbelievably professional guy. So they're just, the truth is, if you're talking about genuinely successful players, there just aren't that many that don't work unbelievably hard. So that's the truth of it.
What's your answer? Neil Back, Richard Hill, Lawrence Allaglio, Anthony Watson, Danny Cipriani, or Ollie Barkley?
What was the question?
Paul Wallace would be one for us as well, wouldn't it? Especially when we were young. Wally could drink God. With the best of them.
And yeah, like, but Wally was massive and shredded
exactly.
And unbelievably strong and explosive and fit and skilled. He was like, he was an absolute freak. And you'd go out with him on a Wednesday night. He used to come round for coffee. And it was like, you want a coffee? Come round for a coffee. And you're like, don't want a coffee. It's 9:30. And he'd like make himself a coffee. And he's like, let's pop out for a beer. And I was like, I don't want a beer. It's 10 o'clock. I don't want a beer. I'm training tomorrow. I'm 18 and 19. No one else to go out with him. I was shit scared of him because he was like a legend and I was a kid. So he used to basically make me go out. And I remember once genuinely going out with Wally after training on a Wednesday. We went out for a sandwich, right? And we were boozing for 30 hours. 30 hours. So I had a full night's sleep. This is honestly, I had a full night's sleep in Eros nightclub in Enfield. I slept for like 7.5 hours overnight.
He was horrific, wasn't he?
Wally's pissed. He's got some bloke in, some bloke who was going shopping at B&Q with his family. I don't know. Drinking at the bar and he woke me up and kept me going. I was like 18 years old. He was shredded.
I saw him last year at a function in the south of France. And that was the function. I saw him only briefly there. And then the next morning, getting going, and Wally's meant to come by and pick me up in a car. And literally all of a sudden, this random bloke just come along, said, Mr. Leonard. I went, yeah, turned around. He's literally got Wally draped over his shoulder. He's gone, I believe he's yours. He goes, I've looked after him all fucking night. And I went like, I said, you can fuck off. I've looked after him for 20 years. Fuck
yeah,
right
exactly.
off. Something like that.
Never known anyone like it until I met... Mind you, unbelievable drinking athlete, Lashley, but you, Jace, and Lowell would drink considerably more than Wally, but you just weren't paralytic after 4 pints. Wally was an absolute lightweight.
He'd be like that, yeah, he would
bollocks
keep going,
after
though,
3 or 4 pints. Bollocks. But he would have another 17 of them. It was just unbelievable.
I'll tell you one in Wales was a nightmare. Mike Phillips. Now, he'd loved partying, loved it, and he would just go out, booze up, getting fights outside McDonald's, the lot. But like they've all said, he would turn up the next day and he would train as hard as he could. And I always remember we had a few beers. We stayed in Heathrow the night before we flew to New Zealand, right? So we had a few beers in the night at the hotel. And we got to the plane then the next day, checked our luggage in, going up the steps of the plane, and the air hostess goes to him, are you business class or first class? And he goes, love, I'm world class. Does not lack confidence, that one.
Did anybody ever see Mike Phillips? Mike Phillips did the best tweet ever that's ever been on Twitter when Twitter was quite new. And he was playing at Bayonne, I think, for a bit before he got sacked. And there's a female rugby presenter. We've got Sarah Elgin, and they've got a female rugby presenter. Don't know her name. Forgotten her name. Anyway, French lady. very, very gorgeous and all that sort of stuff. So he just goes, he knows Twitter's completely public, and he just writes, hello, da-da-da-da-da, are you single? On Twitter straight away, and she says, I'm afraid or not, I'm happily married or I'm spoken for or something like that. And he just sends back a pic, which has been, it's a picture that has been taken by a photographer, so it's not a selfie, and it's like part of a shoot he's done for a magazine or something. And it's Filsy getting out the shower with his, like, he's got a towel around him, he's still soaking wet. The towel's real low, so you can see his gentleman garden, but it's real low, and he's sort of sitting there, and he just, like, looking in the mirror, like, looking amazing. He just sends a picture of that and just says, you sure? I love it. Hashtag 77 caps, he put on it. Genius. Doesn't give a shit. I love that.
Right, should we take
a... we got any more out there? We tell you what we've got here quickly. We've got, we're going to finish soon because we've gone way over for Jay. Sorry, Jason. This is from David Johnson on Twitter. He's asked for an international dream team. No, David, we're not having that because we haven't got all week. What I'm interested in, though, is yourself. I know you wouldn't pick yourself anyway, for modest guy, but take yourself out of it. But who would you be your dream, all-time dream type five? So it's a nerdy question, but I want to know the answer to it. Front row and second row.
Front row, I'd go Loosehead, Oz Durant. Yeah, I'd say Oz, you'd most probably say. Fitzpatrick, one of the best hookers the world's ever seen. Tight head, that's a tough one.
Olo Brown, maybe?
No, Olo Brown was good. I mean, Probin, you could have Probin in there as well. I'd most probably go with Probes, because as tight head goes, he was the biggest cheating bastard the lot of them. Second row is actually, I mean, I'm conflicted in one aspect, because I think Willie John McBride should be there for what he's done for the game and everything. Like, my two second rows most probably would be, because I think they would work perfect in tandem, Martin Johnson at two and John Eales at four.
Yeah, that worked quite nicely, wouldn't it? That worked quite nicely. Another question we got was the toughest player, your hardest ever opponent. So two questions, really. Who's the? These are the sorts of questions that are super nerdy, but people actually love the answers to these, and I do as well, because I'm a rugby fan as well as an ex-player. And the hardest guy you ever played against in terms of just being a horrible bastard, and the best prop you ever played against?
The hardest guy is easy. It's a guy called Norman Hadley, who was Canadian second row captain. Sadly passed away a couple of years ago. How can you describe Norm? 6'8". About 22 or 23 stone. He had a scar down his face like that, and he didn't get that from rugby. That gives you a bit of a clue. I hit him once. I didn't realise it was him. I actually double dislocated my middle finger of my left hand. I've thrown an uppercut where I saw someone in a Canadian jersey, obviously distinct sort of red, white shorts, red socks, stamping on an England player, England versus Canada at Wembley, 1993. And I've hit this guy with a great uppercut, and I felt the crack, my finger, but literally his jaw. So I went, great, lovely. This guy's jackknifed out of this ruck. I've turned around going, cool, that's smart, sort of thing. Like. So I'm now trying to pop my dislocated finger back in, both knuckles. It's a lovely sunny day at Wembley and at the old stadium.
It didn't work, Jason.
No, it didn't work. Really,
it didn't
nice
work.
And straight, look at him. And all of a sudden, I realise I'm in shade. And I'm looking down as I'm trying to pop these knuckles back in. How the hell can I be in shade? And all of a sudden I turn around and there's Norman Hadley standing there. And you can see, first of all, I saw his feet. It's like size 17 boots, then shorts, then shirt, then Norman Hadley. And he had this lump, like literally in between his eyes. And it was going like a Tom and Jerry sketch. It was like, whoop. It was growing that quick. And I've got to say, I've not felt fear many times on a rugby field. And even then I wasn't scared. Even then I wasn't scared. I was scared when he said, is that the best you got, princess?
Yeah.
I was pretty scared then. Which, lucky enough for me, I hit the only bloke who was slower than me around the pitch. Yeah. So he couldn't go.
The hardest prop. Best prop.
Actually, scrummaging-wise, the hardest scrummaging that I never... You normally always get an inch out of someone. You normally get someone back on their heels. One guy that I could never move... I just couldn't move him for love nor money, was when South Africa come after the World Cup win in 95. When they come over here on tour, they got rid of some of their players like Barley Swall and these guys, and they picked this rotund little ginger tight head called Tommy Laubscher, who sadly, I found out a little while ago, he's just passed away. But this guy had forearms on him like this. He had this sort of handlebar moustache, ginger waxed and all this. He had a great big stomach on him like this. And I'm thinking, right, lovely, I can't wait. 60 minutes, I'm having blown out of his arse after 60 minutes. I'll kill him in the last 20 minutes. The last 20 minutes, I just couldn't move him. It was like hitting a brick wall. It was like hitting a brick wall. And how I used to play my, again, when you're trying to psychology with front rowers, you'd start off with what you'd think is a big hit in the game. What I'd want to do as a loose head or a tight head, I'll try and hit my opposite number harder each scrum. You might not be able to follow it up or chase your feet up as much as you can because you're knackered, but as long as you're still hitting them harder than what you did before, then you're rocking them backwards. Once they get on their back, on their heels, then you can chase it up. This bloke, I couldn't move. And I remember shaking his hand afterwards saying, mate, that's amazing. This and the other, he's got a great big stomach on him like this. He was this and the other. And he went, oh, no, we'll have beers and this and the other. So we're having a few beers afterwards. So the next game was, I don't know, Fiji or whatever it was. So you do the analysing of the game. And then I found out why he wasn't knackered. The fucker walked from scrum to scrum to scrum. He didn't run anywhere.
That
he
was
didn't
your
run
error, Jace.
Anywhere. I'm there like going, I wish I'd known that.
That was your error.
I mean, that was a big part of my game was walking. I've got to say that now.
Now we've gone on too long, and Jace, I apologise for that, but it's been great. We've got one final question from Twitter, from Mark Scott on Twitter. Question for Jace. Does he remember the time Eastern Counties played at Warwickshire in the Colts final at Twickenham, and he dressed the Queen Victoria statue at Royal Holloway College in one of the players' kit pissed the night before the final? Is that a bit niche, or is he talking shit?
No, that's true. the reason why I was able to do that, the final in the Colts, was in the semi-final. Do you remember a number 8 that played at Wasps for a while, then London Irish, called Howard Lamb?
No, nothing good to know.
Big chunky guy. He was playing for Middlesex, and I was playing for Eastern Counties in the semi-final of that county competition. And Howard did something that I didn't like, and I decided to kick his head off his shoulders. I got banned for 6 weeks, which was really irritating, because when I went into the actual hearing, I was in the bar beforehand having a beer with a bloke who got less weeks than me, and his nickname was Biff, and I'm going, that can't be right. That can't be right. You've got a nickname Biff, and I'm getting more weeks than you.
Right, so he knew the right people.
And so I got done, so I couldn't play in that final, but they took me along because I'd played in all the games beforehand. But then I was a disgrace the night before the game, so I did get drunk, and I did do that. And I also climbed up the top of the hotel's flagpole and stole their flag as well.
Fucking strong flagpole, that. Excuse my language.
And I actually...
You sure it wasn't a pyramid?
And I remember putting Eastern Counties on it as well, so I had this flag at the game as well. And you've got the hotel, they're going, I'm sure we're missing a flag, so they're like that. It was one of those. So, yes, there's lots of little stories like that about me. Yeah.
Oh, that's great stuff.
There we are.
Ladies and gents, it has gone on a bit longer than that. Apologies to all of you and all of you listening at home or on the Tube. And, again, sorry, Jace, we said an hour. It's gone on a bit. We apologise for that. But we've absolutely loved it. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks to everyone at Token House. Thanks to the Fullers and Guinness and Diageo crew. Top people. Thanks to Michelle for your continued support. We love you, yeah?
Thanks to Pauly.
Thanks to Pauly. Thanks to Pauly to Chimface for introducing us earlier on. He's a great guy.
You two are doing a cycle soon, aren't you? Is that right?
Well, you're at the Atlas Foundation. There's a cycle, Jace. I couldn't make it last year. I mean, I'm very happy to support the charity. It's just, do we have to do the actual bike ride? Can we just not drive it and just donate the...
It's 80 miles. It's 80 miles.
How many days?
It's not easy, mate. It's not easy. I mean, I've got a backside that should never, ever be in a racing saddle. I've got to say that now.
The racing saddle will be in your backside, presumably.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Same as mine, yeah.
It's a tough day, mate, but you'll be able to do it. You'll be able
to do it.
That's
right. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, definitely.
I did one about a year ago, right? Oh, and honestly, my backside—you probably it absolutely kills, doesn't it? I said to my missus, "What do you think that is?" And she said, "Ring sting." I said, well, "What the hell's he going to know?"
Bloody hell! Good night, everyone. Thank you, Jason. You.
Hi, Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.